Good morning and welcome to everyone. This is our Saturday morning Bible study, and we are broadcasting from the North Star Cottage, and it is for the Plainfield Christian Science Church Independent, Plainfield, New Jersey, the United States of America. Welcome, all of you. And our moderator this morning is Thomas from New York.
Welcome, everybody. So I start out our Bible study with a poem from Mary Baker Eddy. 'Tis born on the zephyr at eventide's hour. It falls on the heart like a dew on the flower. An infinite essence from tropic to pole. The promise, the hope, the home, and the heaven of soul. Hope happifies life at the altar or bower, and loosens the fetters of pride and of power. It comes through our tears as the soft summer rain to beautify, bless, and make joyful again. The harp of the minstrel, the treasure of time, a rainbow of rapture o'erarching divine. The God-given mandate that speaks from above. No place for earth's idols, but hope thou and love. So this is Hope from Miscellaneous Writings by Mary Baker Eddy, page 394. This was selected by Linda, so thank you very much. The poem also shows up in the Book of Poems by Mary Baker Eddy.
Beautiful.
All right,
thank you.
Beautiful.
You should be a poetry reader, Tom.
Yes.
You know, every time you read one of these poems, I wonder how could it get any better? But here it is. This is very special. It takes hope out of just the human sentiment and gives it its divine essence. So it's much more than, oh, I wish I had, I'm hoping for something, but rather the power of divinity is brought to bear. Just imagine, it loosens the fetters of pride and power. These are the things that the human mind want to grip more tightly. So what could possibly loosen them? Unless it's the power of divinity. And here we have it in our poem, Hope. I don't want to do all the talking here. I could go on.
No. And Carrie sent us something, an article entitled Saved by Hope by Louisa E. Bell, where she says, hope in Webster is defined as desire accompanied with expectation of obtaining what is desired. Here we may ask ourselves, have we hoped and continued to hope for good, always expecting to receive it? Or have we merely wished for a cessation of pain, trouble, and worry without doing our part in clearing our consciousness of wrong thinking, thus preparing thought for the inflow of good? Then, not experiencing the unearned good, have we become impatient and discouraged, forgetting how frequently we may find hope and patience working side by side and mentioned together in the Bible? Again, have we waited, rejoicing in hope? The prophet Isaiah gives an example of this and of his confidence in God in the words, quote, "It shall be said in that day, lo, this is our God. We have waited for him, and he will save us. This is the Lord. We have waited for him. We will be glad and rejoice in his salvation," end quote. And she says on page 40 of Science and Health, Mrs. Eddy says, "In order to enter into the kingdom, the anchor of hope must be cast beyond the veil of matter into the Shekinah into which Jesus has passed before us. Like our master, we must depart from material sense into the spiritual sense of things, of being. And then the article goes on, let us hope more, expect more. Meanwhile, gratefully acknowledging the help we have experienced by being ready to give an answer to every man that asketh, a reason of the hope that is in us. So that certainly puts hope where it is supposed to be, doesn't it? If we don't have hope in God, we don't have much hope at all.
Well, thank you for that, because I remember before I came here, I did not have hope. And, you know, life was difficult, but without hope, it's just, you know, it felt impossible to get through. And then you come here, and life still presents, you know, challenges to overcome, but you have the hope. And so it just makes it so much better.
I think it's even better when you're learning science. But there is expectation even more than hope. So that's very encouraging, I feel.
I think when it's coupled with the spiritual sense, that is where the hope takes a whole different level.
Mm-hmm. And that's the hope that the world can't take away.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Tom. Anybody else?
I want to talk about the first sentence. 'Tis born on the zephyr at eventide's hour. You know, Mary Baker Eddy has such a visual way of describing things. So I looked up the word zephyr because I did not know what that meant. But zephyr, it says here in Webster's, is poetically any soft, mild, gentle breeze. So now if we think about this, a soft, gentle breeze in the evening. I mean, you think about sort of the calming influence of, you know, if you can visualize, you know, in the evening with a soft, gentle breeze.
And that allusion to the wind or the breeze was used by Jesus also, wasn't it?
Right.
To describe the Spirit of God coming to us. We can't see it or touch it, but we can feel it in our hearts.
And the other thing he said about it is, we may not know where it's coming from or where it's going. That is to say, we don't have any manipulative power over it, but rather it over us. So it's all divinity. It's all the power of God and nothing more.
Thank you.
Well, in that definition that you put in your paperwork, Thomas, it said it was the west wind, and on page 575 of Science and Health, you know, she's talking about the city foursquare, and it says westward to the grand realization of the golden shore of love and the peaceful sea of harmony. So just thinking of that wind coming from there to us.
Oh, that's awesome. A lot of meaning in there. So, and also, you know, I think this is anecdotally, but maybe it's proven somewhere, but that I grew up hearing Mary Baker Eddy wrote with a vocabulary that was, you know, so extensive that it was beyond what most people had ever written. And I think this word zephyr is just an example of her command of the English language.
Definitely.
Yeah, she certainly did. She trained for it and used it for a good purpose, and that's how, you know, it's all part of how God was able to use her. But I think what I get from this is that if our hope isn't based on an expectation, as Florence said, of good from God, then it's really baseless. And it's going to lead to disappointment. But if our hope is in God, in God's provision, in God's allness, in God's perfection, in his love and his care for us, then we have reason for hope. And when people ask us, what is the reason why we are so hopeful? We have to have a ready answer, don't we? And that is our answer.
Okay. Yeah, I think this is an amazing poem because it doesn't use the word calm, but frankly, it just seems to scream calmness as you read this. Like, you know, if your life is all stressed out or you're upset at something or you're reacting to something, I mean, if you read this, I mean, you should become calm, I would think, you know?
Yeah, and if our hope is in God, how can we be otherwise?
Mm-hmm.
But if our hope is in some, you know, one of Earth's idols, then we're not going to be calm at all. That's a good point.
And there's plenty of evidence of that out in the world, that people are not calm relying on worldly things.
Well, and that's right. And that's why people medicate themselves to try to still their uncalmness, if you will. You know,
this goes to show that the answer to a disturbed mentality is to hope thou and love. That's the antidote for it. Because if you're listening to all the news and taking it in, it's nothing but disturbance. That needs to be counteracted. And the counteraction is this divine sense of hope that we've been talking about. And of course, love, as Mrs. Eddy says here in the poem.
Yeah, the answer to the uncalmness is not in alcohol or drugs or any other form of so-called medication.
Yeah, self-soothing, this idea of soothing is tricky because then you're not really facing.
Speak up.
Oh. That speaks to me of the soothing and people looking for soothing rather than rousing their thought with the truth. And it was something I had to work with, is that you want to just that pain to go away, but it teaches you to face what you need to face.
Right.
And also the need for escapism.
Yeah.
If your life is so bad that you need to escape all the time, this should be a sign that you got to change, not plan a new vacation.
Yeah, that's right. Another one of the non-answers is mindless meditation. People like to just like empty their thoughts. Well, yeah, that's impossible to do. But what needs to be done is be filled with something positive and good. There's a reason why one of the words for God is the Rock of Ages. And that's because we need to turn to him for stability.
Kind of like Jacob did, right, Tom?
Okay. So unless there are any other comments, we'll go on to our topic, which is Jacob and Esau. And this specifically is about when Jacob returns back to Canaan and he's going to meet Esau. And there's a lot of trepidation about that, of course, right? So, and in the Bible notes, I do kind of give the background on that. I took out a couple of texts that talks about when Jacob fled and then some texts about when Jacob returned. So the readings are coming from Genesis chapter 32 for the entire chapter, verses 1 to 32, and then chapter 33, verses 1 to 16. So our first question, which is actually probably the one I'm most fascinated with, is what human steps did Jacob take to protect his family and to make amends with his brother Esau. So I wrote that question because I was kind of amazed when you read the story about all the different things that Jacob did. I don't want to answer the question, but you know, it's like he was a very, very active person, positive. So anyway, so that's the question. What steps did Jacob take to protect his family and to make amends with his brother Esau?
I looked up, I went to Bible Hub to just start getting some commentary on this. And the first thing I read was on Genesis 1, Genesis 32:1, and this is a commentary from McLaren that I thought was really beautiful. It says, "It is in the path where God has bade us walk that we shall find the angels round us. The friendly helpers, the emissaries of God's love, the apostles of his grace do not haunt the roads that we make for ourselves. They confine themselves rigidly to the paths in which God has before ordained that we should walk in them. A man has no right to expect, and he will not get, blessing and help and divine gifts when self-willedly he has taken the bit between his teeth and is choosing his own road in the world. But if he will say, 'Lord, here I am, put me where thou wilt, and do with me what thou wilt,' then he may be sure that that path, though it may be solitary of human companionship and leading up amongst barren rocks and over bare moorlands where the sun beats down fiercely, will not be unvisited by a better presence, so that in sweet consciousness of sufficiency of rich grace, he will be able to say, 'I, being in the way, the Lord met me.'" I just thought that was a great beginning to this whole story. And it felt so appropriate with the watching point this week. How if we, Jacob at this point in his life had a lot to lose. He left with nothing. But going back, he was wealthy. Wives, children, grandchildren. I mean, he's a wealthy man. And he's being told to go back and back home. And so in his mind, he's got a lot to lose. But I just love the beginning of that comment. I thought was a perfect, you know, he did what God told him to do, despite the fact that it was such a scary ordeal for him. And Mrs. Eddy says in the watching point, sometimes when she, to get her peace back, she had to do what God wanted her to do, even though it was the hardest thing. That's the only way she was going to get her peace back. So I don't know. I think it was. Anyway.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, the first thing he did was he recognized the angel of God. I mean, angels are all around us, aren't they?
It's our obedience to them. We've got to be obedient no matter what. You have to be obedient to what God is saying.
Yeah, thank you.
And another thing is that Jacob had to realize that in this fight, in this wrestling, that he had to let go of fear and he had to let God be and to feel God, and that's when he was able to get his transformation to become Israel.
Well, if we back up a little bit, you know, Jacob left Esau with an unresolved conflict, so to speak, and no doubt Jacob was dealing with the mental turmoil of whatever that disagreement was, but it wasn't a good parting. So I take it like there was a divine demand that somehow he had to resolve this in his own mind. And
but he had to, He had to let go of fear, you know, because he had to let go of his idea of human good, bad, and good. He had to really go to his spiritual treasury and reservoir.
Right, right. But we're talking about the human footsteps that he
definitely
took. Yeah.
I'm with you there.
So let me just add one thing here. So one of the things he did is he sent messengers ahead to go give a message to his brother Esau. And one of the things that he asked them to say was that he told them that, let's see, quote here, that I may find grace in thy sight. So this is one of the things he did. He sent messengers ahead to tell him that he was coming, mm-hmm. And asked for grace.
And that he had gifts for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
he was offering a lot of his wealth to his brother, that he could find grace in his sight.
But that's also human, right? I mean, he's trying to please a brother. He's trying to, because of his own fear of what's ahead, he's trying to, like, diminish what anger Esau might have. It's wonderful when Esau said, no, I have my own. This is not, you know, I don't need all this. I think that's really great because, you know, you cannot do things humanly, trying to manipulate things. This is what I feel Jacob was trying to do. So.
Yeah, Esau had stuff, but he didn't have his brother.
Yeah.
After that long, I think he was, you know, some of that stuff just heals with time. So
mm-hmm.
Looking forward to seeing his brother.
And then he was told that Esau was coming with 400 men.
Yeah.
And of course that made him even more fearful, so then he tried to see how he could protect his family, so he divided them so that if we went after one half of them, at least he'd save the other. So another you know, human decision to make to save people. But now that's when he found himself, well, now he thinks everybody's safe because I've separated them from each other, and but there he was alone, still struggling with the fear and the doubt and the shame and what he had done. But that attaches itself to a false sense of self, all those feelings and fears. It can only attach itself to a false sense of self.
And that attachment is that human sense of being good or bad. And what happened when he's wrestling is that he overcame that, which is why his name changed and he was transformed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Also, there was that sense of being separated from God. And that didn't help either, because then he felt like he had to do all those human footsteps.
Yeah. That's what happens with fear. It causes us to humanly outline, and it separates us from God, just like Betty said. We don't have the hope, we don't have the trust, we don't have the faith. But when you do have hope, faith, and trust, then things do work out the right way, with peace and harmony.
You're not on the right side if you're doing it humanly, not with God. So everything must be done. If it's right, if it's being done right, then it must be done with God, His direction.
But still, it also, you know, he was, the reason that he received the angel message was because he was willing to do what God was telling him to do. The 23rd Psalm also came to me regarding this story, how it says that love will make, love leadeth us to make us lie down in green pastures, leads us beside the still waters, restores our spiritual sense, and leads us in the path of righteousness, I thought was very appropriate for this story too. He was made to lie down in green pastures. So he was put in this situation in order to receive the angel message that God had, that he was to receive and was always going to if he just followed God's direction. And
me too. I don't know whether this is in line with it, but, you know, sometimes the human steps is what you need to go through. When Jesus was baptized, it's the best example. Suffer it be so now.
Yeah.
So it's not the answer, but it's a humbling process to do everything right humanly. And we know that's not the answer, but it's...
Mm-hmm. Well, of course. No, you're absolutely right. That we have to take whatever footsteps we feel we need to take in order to get to where we need to get to. And he obviously had to take these human footsteps before he could get to where he needed to get to.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was thinking the contrast between this circumstance and the circumstance of David and Goliath, where David knew he was facing an offense to God. And, you know, he ran to meet it. But here Jacob is, as you say, he's got his human concept of his brother, and he's still full of fear of the unresolved basis on which they parted, you know, many years before. And he's going through these human footsteps. Mm-hmm. And those human footsteps haven't really accomplished. Well, we don't know what they've accomplished, but like you say, they're not the answer.
No.
Well, like the first thing, he sent the messengers there to tell them, oh, I've got all this livestock and these servants, and I want to have grace in your sight. I think that was like a somewhat meager approach to try to pacify the situation. And then when he found out Esau's coming to him with 400 men, then he gets a certain amount of livestock together and says, now go back to him and say, we want to give this to you as a gift. So it's a stronger position, but still it's a human footstep to try to pacify the situation. And then the third event in this story is when he was alone, and then he wrestled with a man, and then had to resolve it in his mind.
In Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, I thought this was interesting. He says, Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham, in this great emergency, this is the first recorded example of prayer in the Bible. It is the short, earnest, and bearing directly on the occasion. The appeal is made to God as standing in a covenant relation to his family. Just as we ought to put our hopes of acceptance with God in Christ, it pleads the special promise made to him of a safe return, and after a most humble and affecting confession of unworthiness, it breathes an earnest desire for deliverance from the impending danger. It was the prayer of a kind husband, an affectionate father, a firm believer in the promises.
I think to a large extent, Jacob is referred to as like, he's able to do things on his own, self-reliant, I feel, at that time. And he had to become God-reliant. He had to completely give up self and move into, here I am, Father, guide me, to be able to accomplish what he had to do. It's no more relying on self, my own manipulations and so on, but God guide me.
Yeah.
Of course, surrender, so to speak. Mm-hmm.
in this story about the relationship between Jacob and Esau, I know we've been mostly focusing on Jacob, but Esau wasn't exactly totally innocent in all of this. He did give up his birthright at one point for a meal. And I don't think he truly appreciated what his birthright was until much later in the story where we are now.
This is so true because, you know, we have to see both of them. We cannot just have one is good and one is bad. We have to see that both of them are developing and, you know, and they're overcoming fear, especially Jacob.
Getting back initially to when, upon God's host of angels meeting Jacob on his way, Matthew Henry says, when God designs his people for extraordinary trials, he prepares them by extraordinary comforts. Jacob thanked God. Matthew Henry says, a good man may with an eye of faith see the same that Jacob saw with his bodily eyes. By believing that promise in Psalm 91, verse 11, he shall give his angels charge over thee.
So, Tom, are there any other footsteps that they took that you think need to be brought
well, to you? Well, I'll mention one more. I mean, you know, while he was, we talked about his being fearful and distressed and so forth, but, you know, one of the things he did is he prayed to God. So, you know, he seemed to do a lot of things. He kind of implied he had a lot of things he could give Esau. He asked for grace from his brother, divided everybody into two bands for safety, and he prayed to God. Nothing wrong with that. But it seems like something more was needed. So our question number two is, who did Jacob wrestle with?
All sense of self.
The worst wrestle of all.
Yes.
The toughest gristle of them all.
One of the toughest.
Yeah.
Gives you plenty of employment, Mrs.
Yeah, I have. Yes. I have what you said. Be of good cheer. The warfare with oneself is grand. One plenty of employment. And the divine principle worketh with, I have to turn the page, with you. And then the rest of it is, and obedience crowns persistent effort with everlasting victory. That is miscellaneous writings.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was very scary that he was alone. Mm-hmm. In other words, he was forced to turn to God exclusively.
Yeah.
All of the other steps were proven to be insufficient, not enough, good as they may have been. It wasn't enough.
And he also had to face the fact that, you know, all this wealth that he had attained over the last was not his doing, which, you know, somebody at that point can think that get prideful about what they've accomplished. Look what I've accomplished. Look how wealthy I am. Well, he had to drop all that and see who did provide all that. And it wasn't him. So that had to be dealt with also.
Well, Carrie sent a good article that speaks to this from Edith Rind, entitled No More Jacob But Israel. And the article says that Jacob was actually facing for the first time in his life the result of the past sin of defrauding his brother Esau. Never before had he come face to face with its consequences. And now he was meeting his human concept of his brother, which was an embodiment of hate, revenge, and murder.
He stood alone,
believing himself defenseless before it. With morning about to dawn, the foe to meet, and the fruit of years of toil apparently about to be taken from him. All night, this agony held him in a grip from which he could see no way of deliverance. And then, in his helplessness, he reached out to God until he touched the hem of truth's garment, to use Mrs. Eddy's words on page 270 of Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures. And in that moment of revelation, he saw that omnipresent spirit excluded sin and hate, and man as God's image remained. In that moment, he saw Esau's face as the face of God. The brightness of truth had risen upon him, and the victory was his. To him, there was now the omnipresence of love filling space. The Adam dream as the basis of thought was gone, and his nature was changed. In that night struggle, materiality had been put away in his concept of his brother. As he had seen the face of God, so on the morrow when they met, he found tenderness and love and a generosity which would take nothing from him and could only bless him. Fear, hatred, revenge, resentment had been healed through demonstration as having no place in ever-present love and in consequence no power to circumscribe or limit his right activity. So he went into this thinking that he had an enemy, and he had to wrestle until he came to the realization that he did not have an enemy.
I think his own guilt and everything has made him make a Goliath out of Esau. Really, he was seeing Esau as something, you know, going to do something to him, mammoth, wrong, a big, you know, he got himself even more afraid. So the spiritual sense made him see Esau correctly. Oh, that's question three, sorry.
Well, thank you for that, for weaving in lessons learned from a prior Bible study.
I think also it was, I think it was brought up in a roundtable not too long ago about a story that was in the book, A Gentle Art of Blessing, about this man and his family that were among, I think they were somewhere in Africa or something, but there was a group of terrorists that was going around the neighborhood killing everybody. They just walk into a house and kill everybody. And then they came into this house and just, but the difference between what happened to him and his family was that he just loved. He just saw this group of people with knives and swords and completely differently. In his consciousness, he only saw the child of God. And that's what saved, not only saved their family, but that they stopped doing it. He sat down and talked with them for, you know, quite a while before leaving the house, and that was the end of it. But the difference was what was going on in his consciousness, which is a beautiful story in that book. But that also reminded me, this situation reminded me of that story too. So it's all what's going on in our own thought that tells us whether we have an enemy or a friend. Or, you know, if we see him as a child of God, then that's what we're going to see.
You see what you believe.
That's a great lesson, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And Mrs. Eddy says in her article, love your enemies. She says to love your enemies means that you don't have any enemies. Mm-hmm. The story about Jacob and Esau, which started out as a picture of, you know, a fear, and hate goes with fear, and ended up being a picture of mutual love. So it was resolved that way.
And that's why it's such a wrestle. And that's why our red flags are great. Because if you're feeling that way, no, stop. And love.
Well, yeah, I mean, we've all wrestled, haven't we?
Mm-hmm. Very much.
And that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
this kind of issue.
So in the notes that was provided, this came from a previous Bible study on Jacob and Esau. And right here is a quote. He wrestled with the false concept of himself. What I think is kind of interesting about that statement is that he's not so much wrestling with the problem of Esau, you know, someone else, something external to him. You know, I mean, it's like you have a cold and you pray to get over the cold, and all you think about is, I don't have a cold, right? And, you know, he was wrestling, you know, about himself and how his thinking was. And the other thing that came to me on this was, you know, sometimes Christian Science isn't necessarily just saying a platitude, you know, God is love, therefore I'm okay, I'm healed and everything because I said God is love, right? I mean, he had to work. This was work. He didn't just say, oh, God is love, everything's okay. He wrestled all night.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The amount of fear you've built up yourself by relief makes you like, oh my goodness, it's paralyzing at times, really. Yeah, I mean, because you're so, anyway, I think everybody knows it.
Mm-hmm. I don't and know, now, also in oh, go ahead. I thought in the Bible, I mean, in the Bible lesson, didn't Mrs. Eddy say he was wrestling with a material sense of existence?
Yep, he sure was.
The notes yep. that Tom, your notes are always really good. They're very, very helpful. I really appreciate the time that it takes to come up with these notes because you could come up with a ton of them, but you choose them very well. So I really appreciate that. But in the cornerstone of independent Christian Science, you picked this one out, and it says, to get rid of the false sense of personality, we find our individuality in soul, in God. Jacob was getting rid of the sense of himself as separate from God. This is the process we all have to go through. It can't be avoided. We have to loathe this sense of who we are as separate from God. Then God opens the way. Unless you loathe it, you won't get rid of it. You'll compromise yourself with it. And that word loathe is in the lesson too this week, I think.
Thank you. But this is, I mean, that's why, you know, this is radical stuff. If we're going to be practicing Christian Scientists, we have to be radical in our treatment of the thoughts that come to us. If a thought is not of God, I mean, what does it mean to loathe something?
Hate it.
You got to hate it and detest yeah. it.
If it takes all night.
Well, and it often does. I mean,
if I think of it in terms of, you know, denying God's allness, if I don't really, really hate it and want to be completely separate from it, that help is very helpful for me to think that because God is all, if I accept any of this, then it means I'm denying God in to that extent. And you know, absolutely not. To have God's allness as the reference or what to go to, it's very helpful for me that, no, I'm not denying God, none of this. And so that helps me.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Lawrence.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that helps me too. Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, I mean, to deny the allness of God is a sin, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we should feel pretty badly about ever doing that.
Yeah. Well, it speaks well of Jacob that he was ready to wrestle, unwilling to wrestle, even all night. And even when it looked like the wrestling was over, he refused to let him go till he got the full blessing of it all. You know, it says in the 23rd Psalm, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. The whole idea, if you're in that valley, to go through it. Don't stay there. You know, and here is a picture of Jacob who would not stop working, wrestling as it were, until he got through. You've got to believe that he felt that there was some sense of confidence that there was a light at the end of this tunnel, and he wasn't going to stop until he saw it. And so true it is. You know, error is unreal, as we know in Christian Science, but it also has an end. It comes to an end. It's not a permanent fixture. And in reality, it is no fixture at all. But when we're faced with it, it has an ending point, and we can work to find it and get there.
Yeah, and Mr. Gary said in 2017, after Florence wrote hers, which was commented on already, he said, you said yes. And it's, would you remember what you wrote? Nothing. And, you know, he was tempted, but he kept going, just like Bruce said.
Yeah.
And Mrs. Evans taught us to demand the blessing. And then you can explain that, Mr. Gary, how she said that.
Well, every experience has a blessing in it if we will demand the blessing. Exactly. Sometimes the greatest blessings come from the most difficult tasks.
If you overcome a difficult situation, believe me, the lesson is going to stick with you.
Does it ever?
Yes. Mm-hmm. You never forget. One that I'll never forget. Jacob.
So.
I was just thinking that, you know, during that 20 years of time where he had been away, he had to overcome a lot of adversity. And he had done so with God. God had been preparing him for this point to be able to overcome that last hurdle so that he and Esau could become true brothers in the sense of being brothers and children of God. And so he had been working through some adverse situations prior to this. And so he had built, you know, he'd been building up to this, I think is a good point to do. We don't just come to this suddenly. And also I wanted to say something about Esau had to learn that he hadn't lost anything as well.
Thank you. That's a wonderful point.
Yeah, this brought about a change, presumably, in Esau, right? Because when they parted 20 years before this, Esau promised what?
Absolutely decimating.
Yeah, he promised to kill Jacob.
Mm-hmm.
And that left an impression in Jacob's mind.
See if you forget that.
Well, right. And that's how this whole thing, you know, that's how this particular event started.
Yeah.
That was in his mind.
But they hadn't seen or spoken to each other all those years.
Yeah.
It's not a good probably, way.
Yeah. Every time he remembers Esau in the 20 years, he's imagining all kinds of things. And Herod will do that. You know, magnify it. Oh, you don't know whether Esau was also in that time really considering the whole thing and, you know, becoming more mellow about it. But in Jacob's mind, all he remembers is what Esau's promise had been. And so, you know, just making it bigger and bigger and bigger. So,
yeah. And how often do we hang on to things from our distant past?
How often?
Yeah. Well,
most of the time. Mm-hmm.
But we, you know, we have to clear them up, don't we?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's the beautiful thing about the Bible is that when you're reading it properly, like we've been taught in Christian Science, to take it metaphysically, spiritually, and see it as a universal truth. It's not just little, as Eddie says, if you read it like a history book, it's of no value whatsoever. But we see it as universal truth. Then we can apply these situations to our present situation. And there's a lot of revenge being expressed in the world today, and hate and all that. So I think this story is very appropriate for what we have to handle today. I also like the universality of these stories. I mean, it's just, we have to apply it today, or what use is it to us?
Right.
Why the hate? Why so much hate? Mm-hmm.
This conflict appears to be continuing, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't have the exact quote, but this is what he says, in taking offense, to go forth in this world with a love that's large enough to neutralize with what's bitter in it.
Yeah,
that's one of the main lessons of the story of Jacob, is the power of love. That's the final thing in it, is love.
And isn't that the only...
So, yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
Go ahead, John.
Okay, so our third question is, and we can expand on this based on the comments, right, is how did Jacob see Esau, and how did Esau see Jacob? It's a wonderful bringing together two brothers. So what do you think?
Well, I know they mention in the Bible how Jacob approaches his brother, and he bows seven times in deference, but Esau runs and embraces him. And then they cry.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very beautiful.
Yeah.
I love the part how Esau runs and embraces him.
Yeah. Fell on his neck and kissed him.
Yeah. They saw each other correctly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting, too, because Esau, throughout his whole story, he wanted what he wanted in the moment. That's why he gave up his birthright for that meal. that's why he was mad to begin with. And at the end, he wanted Jacob, and he just wanted him. He didn't want the...
I think, too, it's all about this metaphysical, energetic thought process in step two in the questions. Because Jacob wrestled and wrestled and wrestled and was able to see correctly, it dissolved all of that amplified, what happened 20 years ago, and Esau felt it.
Mm.
He felt it.
So I thought I'd just make a couple points, which I think we've already talked about, but it's kind of interesting when we talk about healing that there's a sense of completeness on this. So, for example, after Jacob had done his wrestling all night, he said, the name of the place, Peniel, for I have seen God face to face and my life is preserved. So there's a sense there from Jacob that everything was okay before he saw his brother, right? And then the other we talked about is how Esau changed. So this healing was very complete.
Yeah, and we talked about it earlier. The healing took place in Jacob's consciousness, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the wrestling took place.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Where the healing took place. And, you know, Mrs. Eddy explains so well in Christian Science that, you know, what we see as reality is really a function of what's in our consciousness. And what's important, essential, is that our consciousness be filled with an understanding of God, because that's the only way we can understand who we are. What little understanding we have of God is what we are. And the only healing balm, she says, is divine love. And he learned love Esau as his neighbor.
I would like to lovingly offer this inspiration, and from what I have practiced, very lovingly, because it's about all this love that we manifest and all the love that we reflect from divine love also is extended to all beings and all creatures, right? And when I heard, well, he wrestled because he was thinking about killing. If we extend that to all creatures, that goes for all humanity also, with the creatures of God. And like I said, very lovingly, I offer this. We are killing millions every day just because we want to eat them. I am talking about a plant-based way of living. And I said I offer this lovingly because I have gone this way for 17 years now, and I can see the difference on the peace and not wrestling from knowing, because we consciously know that we are these food cups. Even if we don't want to wrestle with it, the wrestling will be there because we know. And when we know, we cannot erase that, right? We know, all humanity know where this food comes from, and it's from killing, and we will always wrestle for that. So I'm saying this for peace for humanity.
Thanks. And Mrs. Eddy does tell us that God's ideas are not carnivorous, right?
Yes.
So
one of the
divine love was the answer.
And I think definitely everybody's getting there. We all get there.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. One of the things too that I've learned since coming here is the difference, what a demonstration really is. I always thought the demonstration was the actual physical healing, you know, the feeling, the change in the body or whatever. But the demonstration is really mm-hmm. what goes on in thought, the healing in thought. So the demonstration was made when Jacob saw who he really was and who his brother really was, the child of God. That's the demonstration. The rest of it, like Mary likes to say too, is the byproduct, the coming together with the hug, the, you know, the making up. And that was the result of the demonstration that was made during the night. And that I have a better understanding of what really the demonstration is.
Thank you. Yes, because the tendency for a lot of people, and I know I've had to deal with this myself, the tendency is when you have demonstrated health, when you've demonstrated prosperity, when you've demonstrated the allness of God in your life, and you have good health, and you have prosperity, and you have the things humanly that God provides spiritually, the tendency is to worship the effect rather than the cause. And that is a big mistake.
Mm-hmm.
We should see, and this is a matter of how do we see all the Esaus in our life? Right?
Yeah.
Do we see them as God's perfect spiritual idea and blessing? Or do we see them as, you know, good friends or tasty food or not tasty food or a big bank account or a small bank, you know? Do we see what is around us as God's provision? as spiritual ideas and love God for providing them.
I think the thought of God's completeness and our completeness when we fully represent or reflect Him is so important, because it's always there. The completeness is there. It's just reworking to know ourselves as such. And whatever it takes for us to learn it, well, that's what we each on our own going through, to learn as much as we can. That you know, I love that morning treatment for every day when it says I'm complete. It's always there, it's always operating, but it's up to us to get to know it and live it, as you say.
I think it's so wonderful that you say complete. That's a great, great thought, of course. And like all the commandments, right, we will try to live them completely. Love your neighbor as yourself, seeing them perfect. And also all the other ones. It does say you should not kill. And it doesn't say you should not kill humans. It said you should not kill, period. And so it will give us all completeness to look at all the commandments, right? That's a wonderful thought. Thank you.
Okay. Any other thoughts?
Well, I think we had a good discussion today. Yes?
Yes.
Yeah. Very good.
Very good. Very good.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah. So let's not forget, I know a lot of people contribute things after the Bible study, but if you haven't thought about it, then please make some contributions after the Bible study. We'll get those posted. They're very enriching. When you look back at some of the archived Bible studies and you read the notes, the articles that have been added after the Bible study.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.